For the sake of accuracy, by the way, with respect to Bangladesh, the population is somewhere between 147 and 150 million people, for the sake of accuracy. All right, coming up in a moment, Paul Eno, who has been called the most intelligent voice in paranormal research today. He began his long career as a paranormal investigator in 1970 at the age of 17. He is a graduate of two seminaries, holder of a degree in philosophy, and an award-winning New England journalist. Paul is the author of 7 books, including 5 on paranormal subjects. He is a fellow of the American Society for Physical Research and a veteran of the U.S. Coast Guard. In addition, Paul has had hair-raising adventures with famous hauntings. Oh, that'll be interesting. And has unique theories about the paranormal and its meaning for our understanding of God, the world, in ourselves. That's it. Coming up in a moment, Paul Eno. You know, it's funny, when we do these programs, they give us a little sheet, you know, with the bio on it, and then a list of suggested questions. And the first one is for Paul Eno. I guess I'd first like to say, Paul, welcome to Coast AM as a first-timer, I guess, on the program, right?
Well, actually, a second time.
No, second.
But it's a first time with you.
Okay. Well, the first question, suggested question, says, your vision of the paranormal seems much deeper than most people's. How do you define the paranormal? What are some of the normal paranormal experiences we have every day? And so forth and so on. Well, I haven't talked to you yet, so I don't know that it's much deeper than most people, but it probably is since you've written 5 books on the subject. Anyway, we're sure going to find out. What got you interested, Paul, in this incredible subject?
Well, actually, well, first of all, let me congratulate you on your new daughter.
Thank you.
And it's a good thing you're used to staying up all night.
Now that you've said that, that's when she wakes up at night. Now, Aaron and I used to spend, you know, we go to bed typically at 4 or 5 in the morning, and that's exactly how she's behaving. So it's good for us, I guess.
Well, she'll either be your successor or mine. I'm not sure which. In any case, I started out as a seminary student, of course, in 1970. And from the very first hour of my very first case, I began to question the traditional, you know, 19th century understanding of what ghosts are. You know, spirits of the dead, they exist in a spirit world separated from ours by a veil of some kind. You know, from day one, it just didn't hold up. Now, you may wonder, first of all, why not only one seminary student, me, but 5 others were out looking for ghosts in the first place. Not the usual activity you think for students for the
first. Very much wonder about that, Paul, because I thought the traditional religious belief was kind of like this, that we die and then we're dead until resurrection time or what have you. But don't most traditional religious beliefs not embrace ghosts at all?
Well, that depends on the religion. And in the case of Roman Catholicism, there was and is a doctrine known as purgatory. And I'm sure most people are familiar with that, whether
yes.
to do with Roman Catholicism. My theory, you know, strange as it may seem now, was that these ghosts, which obviously were present in every culture and every time and well known to humans throughout history, were in fact souls in purgatory. That's the theory I started with. And that's why a bunch of us were out without the knowledge or approval of our church superiors, I might add, in the woods of northeast Connecticut, I should say, in 1970-71, doing these things. So, but as I say, from day one, it just didn't add up. The phenomena that we encountered seemed to demonstrate the presence of people who showed no sign whatsoever of being dead at all, never mind of being in purgatory. You know, for example, on that first night, we stood there and we heard, and this place is all overgrown woods. It had been an abandoned settlement many, many, many years before it had been occupied. But there was a brook, and there were the sounds of children laughing and running up and down this brook. We couldn't see them, and they were running or moving in such a way that seemed extremely quick, unnaturally rapid. The sounds would not record. We had recording equipment because this is the 70s, the seat of the pants here. No cell phones,
sure.
no Gauss meters and this sort of thing. But we had recording instruments.
You could see these children?
We could not. We could only hear them.
You could hear them.
We could hear them.
And so you could detect movement?
Exactly. And when you walked into this area, even during the day, you could hear the sounds of farm implements, dogs, cows, people. It was a normal day in the life of, you know, somebody else. And we made it a point to check the entire area within the radius of over a mile, and the only thing that was present there was a 4-H camp with a couple of counselors there and no campers. I mean, there simply was no way that these sounds were made by anything nearby. All right, so this really began to make us wonder. One incident that I repeat frequently because it makes the point is what happened to us as we were leaving our second trip to this place, which was in the fall of 71. And we heard an ox cart coming toward us down this old path. And it sounded so real that we literally got out of the way to let it go by. And sure enough, there was the sound of I guess, oxen, wooden wheels, proceeding through an area very nearby, no more than 10 or 15 feet away, that had been a road about 150 years before. A couple of us stepped toward it, and all of a sudden we heard a guy yell, "Hya!" and a crack of a whip. And we couldn't see the bloody thing. Right by us. We all stood, you know, there was seven people now sort of who were experiencing this, and it was just, it really, really shook us up. This is our first case.
Oh, I'm sure it shook you up.
And I began to wonder immediately, you know, are we dealing perhaps more with time than we are with death? Questions would arise such as, you know, without your body, are you still you? Mm-hmm. You know, why do people see ghosts, you know, fully clothed, you know, acting and speaking as they did in quote-unquote, in life, unquote. You know, and these are questions that began to really vex me, and as I proceeded through my early years in this field, it really began to be, I began to say what even experienced paranormal investigators will sometimes say today, the longer I do this, the more questions I have.
Okay, let me stop you for a second, because you mentioned children. Over the years, I've done a lot of shows, Paul, with a group from Utah, that record EVPs, and I know that you know what EVPs are.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have tried six ways from Sunday. They're not a profit group. They don't write books. They don't make money. They just do this because they believe in it. Now, over the years, Paul, I've heard some voices recorded that, God, I would say 50% of what I hear, number one, are children. And it's kind of heartbreaking, Paul. They're children. And sometimes they say things that, you know, like it's cold in here, or it's dark and scary here, or, you know, things like that. I can't shoot holes in this technology. I just can't. And nor the motives of those who are doing the recording. I believe it's true. I believe these really honestly are voices from elsewhere, but it raises so many questions, Paul.
It does. Well, I have looked, obviously, at EVPs, and of course we didn't really think of it in that way in the 70s and 80s, but as time has gone by, you know, everybody knows that it's become a popular medium for recording these things. There are many explanations, and you certainly know as a person who's a professional in broadcasting that there are possible explanations other than, you know, the one that's kind of accepted in the supernatural vein. One thing I ask myself is I've also heard a lot of children. I've also heard them in emotional situations.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens in emotional situations? My point of view over the years has become that we're not dealing with a spirit world and a physical world. We're dealing with many, many, many worlds. I eventually started to base theories, because it's the only way I could explain what I was seeing and hearing in these cases, on quantum physics. Now, of course, that's a popular, I guess, way to do it these days, but there's a theory in quantum mechanics, which not everybody accepts, but it's called the bubble theory
right, of
the universe. Okay.
Well, I know about it.
Sure. So I believe, and I believe I actually have photographs of the boundaries of these things, that when we are seeing or hearing these things, we are very possibly seeing or hearing live people who are going about their day
elsewhere,
saying things in these parallel worlds, these bubble universes. And when we have, I've seen in many cases, when we have emotional experiences, when we have traumatic experiences, even fears, anger, things like this, it sends out waves, if you will, almost like a rock thrown into a pond,
mm-hmm,
across the multiverse. And I think that those are the things that you're very likely to see and hear in paranormal experiences.
That sure makes sense to me.
Things overlap.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me, Paul. You know, in here it says, why are we so fascinated with paranormal? That's so easy. I mean, isn't it the biggest question of all?
It is. That the paranormal is the mother of science, and it's the mother of religion. You know, I laugh almost when science and religion come to grips, you know, or don't come to grips with this subject, because they're both the children of the paranormal. Had there been no questions to be answered, had there been nothing unexplained, we would never have asked the questions that started science or religion.
Well, I mean, what happens to us when physical life ends? There is no bigger question.
No, there isn't.
There isn't. There isn't. So why are we fascinated with paranormal? Because we want to know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So no, I think your idea is...
account dwindles to insignificance as a question when it comes to questions of life and death and life, you know?
I think you may be onto it. Maybe these are just sort of, I don't know, breakthrough echoes from a multiverse.
Well, that's my opinion. And as I say, I didn't, like, ace my way through physics in school, okay? But nevertheless, this is what I believe I see going on four decades in the trenches. I don't see any other way to explain this stuff. And I'll go through all the cases that you want tonight to illustrate this, stuff that knocked my socks off and still do, you know.
All right. Here's a question I really do want to ask, because I've been troubled by this for years in dealing with the whole paranormal field. Being able to distinguish between somebody who's having a legitimate paranormal experience and somebody who has a legitimate mental illness. And that's tough. I can tell you, Paul, I get, 3,000 emails a day, something like that. I mean, a lot. I get a lot of email. And even in the emails and the stories that you get, trying to make that distinction is really hard.
It is. Well, as a matter of fact, when I was in the seminary, I pulled a few strings and got them to set up a course in abnormal psychology for me, which I continued into my graduate studies. And the idea was that I had some sympathetic faculty members, I wanted to see what precisely the difference was between people who have mental illnesses and people who are having paranormal experiences.
Right.
And believe me, I got an eyeful. I worked at the former, fortunately, Ogdensburg State Hospital in New York State and Norwich State Hospital in Connecticut. And at each place, I encountered a lot of strange things. Have you ever looked into the eyes of a schizophrenic?
Yes.
It's a very, very disconcerting experience in some cases because of the knowing look you get in return.
That's right.
I got the impression very strongly over a period of several years or at least the question arose, is it possible that rather than having chemical imbalances in their brains that create the illusions of what they imagine, is it possible that they have doors in their minds open to worlds that really exist?
That's right. Seeing and hearing things that we are not.
Yeah. And so, you know, and what were these people, how were these people treated in so-called primitive societies? Generally, they were considered holy.
Yeah.
And we consider them nuts.
Yeah, that's right. And even more worrisome, Paul, if a percentage of these, whatever percentage, are legitimate paranormal experiences, people who are hearing and seeing things that are real to them and we just can't see it, then how many sane, but let's see, what would be the right word for them? Sane, but sensitive in a way that we are not, people are in asylums.
There aren't that many people in asylums anymore. I was working when there were a lot more inpatients than there are today. Today, they fill your pockets with Librium or Prozac and off you go.
Yeah.
And what does that do? And I've actually addressed groups of psychiatrists on this, and one of them, they'd come up to me at the end and say, you're going to wreck psychiatry? I said, first, I don't have the slightest influence to do anything at all to psychiatry. And secondly, I think you people ought to look at this subject, because I'm not competent to answer these questions. And privately, several of them will always come up to me and say, you know, I've wondered the same thing. There are just too many unanswered questions here.
Right.
Sometimes I would encounter people who apparently had mental illnesses and paranormal phenomena intermixed. Talk about, you know, getting into a tangle. It's a really, really difficult but important question.
It is. And I wonder how many people are either institutionalized or laid out by Prozac or whatever the latest is. That ought not be, because they really are experiencing what we just simply can't detect.
Well, I hear from people all the time who are victims of this, seemingly, and they ask the same questions. And we need people working on these issues. And, of course, that implies that we have to adopt a new worldview, a holistic worldview, that modern medicine is just kind of beginning to do, but is kind of reluctant to do, you know, and they've only just come to grips with acupuncture. I mean, never mind the paranormal mixing with alleged mental illnesses. So I mean, these are questions. As I say in my book, in my last book, it's the first day of school.
Well, all right, you had that experience where you heard the children, you heard the ox, and all the rest of it. What other experiences have you had that you would say definitely made a believer of you?
Oh, goodness. How long is your show?
It's a long show.
Yeah. Well, certainly there was the Weeping Indian Ghost, 1972, the Case of the Disturbed Grave, 1973, but probably the one that really gave me a baptism by fire was in 1974 when I was working with Ed Lorraine Warren, and it was the Bridgeport, Connecticut poltergeist outbreak. Now, if anybody is of our vintage, they may remember that all over the news. There was headlines all over the world. And it was Bridgeport, Connecticut, and there was a little girl involved, her two parents, and the things that occurred were such as this. I stood in the kitchen with a number of Bridgeport policemen and firemen, and we saw a 300-pound refrigerator pick itself up, turn itself around, put itself back down again.
Oh, my God.
Stuff was flying off. I myself was injured by a flying television set.
What?
And, oh, yes.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
and there are police officers to back this story up.
Absolutely, yeah. I have copies of official police reports from this case.
God, I'm sorry. This is what I missed. I had no idea.
Oh yes, yeah. The 1974 Bridgeport. One of the police officers came into the house. Stuff was flying around. He backed down the sidewalk, sat in the cruiser, wouldn't come out. In 1998, I was doing a book signing for Faces at the Window, and a young woman came up to me and said, my grandfather my father was a firefighter in Bridgeport at that time, and we couldn't find him for 3 days. He had been to the house, was so frightened, he went into the apartment above their garage and wouldn't come out. So, I mean, this really shook people up. The woman in the house, Mrs. Gooden, her name was injured by a flying television set as well. Her toe was broken, and when I was arriving, she just was arriving from the hospital. And
Can you back up on this story a little bit? Because I haven't heard it. I don't know why and how I've not heard about it before, but I'd kind of like to know how this began and hear more about it in detail.
Sure. Okay, well, if I knew then what I think I know now, I'd say it started this way. There are entities that I refer to as parasites. Okay, these are not human, not nice entities whom I believe live in other parts of the multiverse, if you will, and who literally live by sucking our energy. Well, what are the earliest traditions of vampires? I mean, way back, ancient China, ancient Middle East. They're, and this is an actual translation from the ancient Babylonian, life-sucking ghosts.
Yeah, that's like succubus, right?
Exactly. And this is what these entities that I would run into who did not seem to be human would do. And I believe that a poltergeist is one of these entities, one of these parasites, who's gotten so much to eat, if you will, that it becomes unbelievably powerful and it can seemingly manipulate space and time, such as by, throwing refrigerators around. So this case began with me on the way down to the Warren's house to hopefully have dinner. I was home from the seminary for Thanksgiving vacation, so I thought. And when I came up to their house in Monroe, Connecticut, Lorraine came running out and said, "Paul, are you in a high spiritual state right now?" which was her way of saying, there's a big case about the break, and, why don't you come along with us?
All right, hold it right there. That's a good point to sort of hang people up, if you will, a hook, I think they call it, Paul. So this is the Warren case. And, yes, of course, I've heard of the Warren case, but televisions and refrigerators flying around, that one, well, I hadn't heard that. We'll be right back. Here I am. Paul Eno is my guest. We're talking about the paranormal, and he obviously is well qualified to be talking about it and has a lot to say. I can't resist. I get these fast blasts as the show goes along. And here comes one from Steve in Clearwater, Florida. an obvious spokesperson for the anti-global warming crowd, and he says, and I'll give it to you exactly, Art, the sea level is not going to raise, that's R-A-I-S-E, if all the ice melts. I'm so sick of you people saying it. It's like ice in a dumb glass, that's D-U-M glass. When the ice melts, it does not, D-O-S-E, does not flood onto the table. It is absorbed into the glass, and the seas is much bigger than the ice cap. And Steve is writing from Florida. We'll be right back. Well, all right, back now to Paulino. And Paul, I really do want sort of a detailed story about the Warrens. My God, I had no idea some of that went on.
Anyway, you're very welcome to all the description you need. We were, I went into the city and found this little bungalow in the city of Bridgeport. And the first thing that happened was the woman came out and grabbed my arm as soon as I was introduced as a seminary student, brought me in and said, have you ever seen anything like this in your life? And I never had. The place was an unbelievable disaster. The thing, as she called it, had taken clothes out of their drawers. They'd flown across the room into the little girl's toy baby carriages. She had several of those, and then the thing would push them around the house. Now, this wasn't happening when I first went in. Religious pictures and pictures of all kinds, really, had come off the wall and had been flying around. Silverware off the sink. Everything you can imagine was either on the floor, off the wall, or in the bathtub. Immediately, as soon as I arrived, things would begin to fall from the shelves in the bathroom into the bathtub. But that was pretty much the only thing that happened, because I found a pattern that I found in other cases of this kind in this Bridgeport house. For one thing, once we heard the story of how the family had begun to experience this, it became obvious that they had been in this house for a very long time with a lot of pent-up energy. In other words, the little girl had been, they were overprotective of this child. She'd mm-hmm. been adopted, and she had been in school and had been abused by some of the other students by being kicked in the back and had been slightly injured, and she had been in the house for 6 weeks. Hadn't been allowed to go outside, had no friends, and the people themselves were not very active in the outside world. The fellow went out to work every day, but the mother was home. Everything was in this house, all pent up, okay? That's one thing. Secondly, we had a situation where they were very, very religious. Now, strangely enough, I found that people who are very religious, these people were devout Roman Catholics, they often have more of this trouble than other people do. Right? I started to wonder about that question.
Do you have any thoughts on why?
Well, they seem to be fixated on the spiritual in a way that is not entirely healthy. I sometimes find, not to criticize anybody's spiritualities, but I sometimes find that there are spiritualities that are some are less constructive than others. Some are less positive than others. In recent years, of course, a lot of positive things have come into some of the spiritualities that weren't, and that's another issue. But I think that there was a lot of negativity in the spirituality of the old-timers, so to speak, sometimes in the Roman Church, and this did not help. There was a lot of fear. When it's based on fear rather than love,
right.
It seems to, well, not maybe attract, but that doesn't seem to harm the presence of these parasites that I mentioned before.
Well, I certainly agree with you that dwelling on things spiritual invites them in. It opens the
in a negative way, yeah.
Yeah, it opens the first door that allows them in.
That's it. And I always find that the ducks, as it were, have to be lined up just right for these things to occur, particularly poltergeists. And you had, number one, this kind of fixated kind of negative spirituality. You had these people sort of fixated on each other just in this little house, sure. You know, and having no outside connections, really. In any healthy way. That was the other thing. You had a little girl who was reaching the age of puberty. She was 10 years old and just sort of coming up and starting to grow. And this often is parapsychologists will say, well, this is the age where a lot of poltergeists will strike. Now, they will generally say that poltergeists are things that form from energy that come out of the people with traumatic experiences or children going through puberty or whatever. And I don't believe that. I think these are parasites which feed upon that energy and just get stronger and stronger if people allow them to. So in any case, in this house, we had all these things going on. I find that when I or someone, not just me, but anyone else who comes into the mix, so to speak, is not known to the entities, things will quiet down. I usually find things will quiet down when I go into a house for the first day or so. Right, but we were there for 3 days. We really didn't leave very frequently, only to eat. And even then, it wasn't. One of us was usually there. One of us, me, being either Ed, Lorraine, or me.
They wanted you there. Why? They wanted this figured out. They wanted you to exorcise it, get rid of it, whatever.
They wanted us to come in and fix it.
Okay. Yeah.
Now that's in ensuing years, I find that's really not how it works. All right. Now we also had a priest with us, Father Bill Charbonneau, who I believe is still a priest of the Archdiocese of Hartford, Connecticut, and I have not heard from him in a number of years, but I believe he's still there. And gets away somehow with being a paranormal investigator, or did. And so there were really four of us here. We had requested that, and of course, with my theological background at the time, I believed that these were demons, okay? And again, you know, these are words for realities that we've always experienced, all right? And I find that our language is not really quite up to talking about this stuff.
It isn't. I mean, if you can use the word parasites, or you can substitute the word demons, I suppose.
You can. In a way, they're interchangeable, but demons has a lot of theological baggage that I'm not prepared to attach to parasites at this point. However, okay. At that time, I was. So we contacted the Diocese of Bridgeport, Connecticut. The bishop didn't want to even hear it, okay, and the chancellor of the diocese said, forget it. They were not going to come in. And of course, the problem was that the press had gotten wind of this, and there were literally policemen and firemen and reporters walking in and out of this house with impunity. And I said to Ed, you know, how can you have, this is chaos. We can't, how can we get anything done in here? Because we were trying to observe, in order to determine whether this really was a demonic infestation, which, right, given the nature of the phenomena, didn't take us long to answer in the affirmative.
Why do you think the bishop was uninterested? I mean, based on the kind of thing you were telling him, the sort of things you're telling me, why not?
Well, because the film The Exorcist had just come out.
Oh.
All right. And you had a priest in there getting thrown through the window, and you had people outside this house. According to the police, there were up to 10,000 people gathered outside this house at the height of this. And they fully expected Father Charbonneau or me to come flying out this window, like the priest did in the movie. People are not generally in this realm deep thinkers, okay? Not to seem smug, but they just aren't.
And the exorcism ritual is an old, well entrenched, if not frequently used, a thing in the Catholic Church, right?
But they don't do it when reporters are standing in the room.
Okay.
And that was the real problem. Later on, I understand that a priest did come in, and Father Charbonneau at the time did bless the house, and things quieted down for a few hours, but then they started up again. But to make a long story short, I did witness all these things that I mentioned. I was standing in the kitchen at one time, and my job in this case was pretty much to keep an eye on the little girl to make sure that she was not doing any of these things. Okay. Now, there were one or two things that she was doing. Now, she'd be in her 40s today. She had a cat, and the man, Mr. Gooden, her father, adopted father, swore that this cat would come to the top of the stairs and demand in a voice to be let out. Okay, all right. And this story got out to the press, and with all the bizarre things I've seen in my life, Art, I'll never forget the sight of reporters from ABC, NBC, and CBS standing in front of this cat holding microphones out to it, asking to say something. All right, because we're close to New York here, so up they came. Well, it seemed very clear to me that the girl was making these noises, but other than that, I mean, a girl picking up a 300-pound refrigerator?
No way.
You know,
nor a TV.
A 200-pound bureau across her own room. She wasn't even in the room.
Right.
At one point, among the many things that happened, it was we'd been in the house for at least 2 days, and the Warrens had gone off to be on a television program, and I was in the house myself. There was a Bridgeport Post reporter, a neighbor, and the family. Something began arriving. This was my first real experience with what I today call parasites. I got the very strong impression. And I say impression, you want to call it psychic, whatever. I mean, I wouldn't dare mention it. It was bad enough I was doing this in the eyes of my church authorities, but if I'd mentioned anything about psychic or mediumistic, I would have been out the door like a shot.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept quiet about this, but I felt very clearly four entities arriving. They did not feel human to me, but they did not feel evil either. They felt sterile, lifeless, but yet they were alive. This is the best way I can describe it. They arrived in her room, and I could see four, they're very, dimly, of course, gauzy kind of figures. The air was full of electricity. And these are all things that I would experience many times in the future. You know, I got to know how these things were acting and everything else. And in they came. I put the little girl instinctively. I put her behind me. And one of them stood right in front of me, got around me, and threw her across the room. The family, the mother began to cry. I began to read a prayer. But the thing, and here's the mistake that I made and that I learned you never do again, and that's I became angry. And the thing fed upon it. Again, it got stronger and stronger and stronger.
Mm.
So I pulled the family out of the house, and we went and stood on the sidewalk. Fortunately, the police had cordoned off the street at either end, and there was nobody. We wouldn't go into the middle of a crowd. But I find that when you are, these things, they feed upon fear, anger, enmity of any kind, hatred, and I can't put a scientific finger on that, but that's what happened.
You know, and a number of other ghost encounters that I believe were true, the person also got angry, and it really escalated the whole thing.
Absolutely. This is what these things eat. And that's the clearest I can put it. They're cosmic mosquitoes, if you will. And I believe they're responsible for our legends of demons, vampires, or what have you, whatever word you want to put on them. And I feel they are a real danger, not only to families, but, you know, not to get nuts with this, but, I mean, you wonder, you know, what influence do they have in the halls of government? Because they're very intelligent. They learn very quickly. I've seen some that have followed families for generations. I'm working with a, I can't tell you who it is, but she's in upper west side of New York, a sort of a significant cultural figure in American culture. And apparently there's a parasite that has followed the family for some time, and we're working with that now to put it to bed, so to speak, and help this person.
These parasites, these are not humans. These never were, in your opinion, human?
Well, even the terms like were and are don't have much meaning in the multiverse because there is no time. You know, even Einstein recognized that.
Right.
However, it is a good question. You know, is it possible that these are, or in our terms, were human? I have never encountered one that, in my opinion, was human. Now, on the other hand, I see no logical reason why they shouldn't be. I mean, we all know parasitic humans, you know, and vampiristic people, for heaven's sake. You know, why shouldn't this continue? Perhaps there's so little humanity left that I just can't tell, you know. When we get into the depths of multiverse thinking, as I call it, if you want to call it the theology or the philosophy of the multiverse, what it means for us, you start getting into shared lives. And in a way, we share the lives of these things in a very real way. But that, I'm jumping the gun here, but I mean, that's another question. But I believe they are, if you want to call them alien, you wouldn't be wrong.
I was about to bring that up. I was going to say, under some circumstances, somebody might say extraterrestrial, and that word would just be fine.
Well, I suppose it would. We're trained through science and science fiction, certainly, to think of aliens as being from other planets, but I think they're from other universes.
But without question. I mean, you saw things flying across the room. You saw it with your own eyes.
I did buy them. Oh, yeah, this is all in the presence of witnesses. And the little girl and, you know, the whole schmear, I mean, it's all... You know, it's in my 1998 book. It's all in there, including the copies of the police reports.
Was the little girl the source of this, in your opinion?
No, I believe she was the focal point of it, because she was tremendously pent up, as I described. And these things, and you know, I find that a number of things, the number of ducks, as I say, have to be lined up. Not just the people, not just the spirituality or lack thereof, but the geotechnics under the house.
A conduit for it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, what are we dealing with here? What's the glue that holds the universe, or we want to say the multiverse, together? It's electromagnetism, right?
Yes.
We're electrical. Our muscles, our brains, and
oh,
so
yes.
Are these things. They're part of nature. You know, I mean, I don't even believe in the term supernatural. These things are part of nature, and they're just, it's a part of nature we just haven't really defined yet.
At any point, did you enter into any form of communication with them?
That's a very good question. I have, in this particular case... I did not. However, in subsequent cases, I have, I believe, studied them in a very intimate way. There were cases where, and this is mainly in the 1990s, I really started doing this. One case in particular, I'm thinking of in 1998, in which and people ask me, what is the worst case you ever deal with? And I say, well, they're sometimes the quietest cases. They're the ones where the victim in the case develops a bond with the parasite. And you think of the old stories of vampires, you know, with their slaves or whatever. And I had a woman in Rhode Island who was writing love poems to this thing. She was convinced that it was a lover from a former life and all this kind of stuff. But I went in and I did the thing, had Parasite written all over it. It would hide out in the wall, if you don't mind, of the boys. There was a young boy in the house, 8 years old, and I don't like that at all when they're hanging around kids, to say the least. And she immediately began to respond to what I was saying. She recognized it, and she began to become positive. And my prescription for these things is you bring in, it's the Peter Pan theory, so to speak, think happy thoughts. Bring in positive energy to displace the negative energy.
Right.
Best way I can put it, and it works every time. So she immediately responded to that and began to do it. So there wasn't any real emergency here. So I had a chance to sit in this room and study this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it knew I was there. I certainly knew it was there. And this is the best way I can put it. I really got a feeling we had each other's numbers. This thing was very, very ancient, with whatever meaning that can have in the multiverse. It was very wise. It had done this many, many times. And it was definitely not human.
And would you describe it as neutral, or did it have evil intent? I have to use these words for the audience, or was it...
Of course. Well, again, morality and evil intent, these are, I hate to use the term relative, but they really are. This thing was, I mean, does a mosquito consider itself evil when it bites you or gives you, you know...
no, just hungry.
Or whatever. It was neutral. It was neutral.
Neutral.
It was. I've seen. I think there are a number of species of these things, and I've seen them neutral. I've seen them very hostile, and I've seen them almost not friendly, but not. We'll say non-hostile. They seem to have a culture. They seem to have at times clear leaders. I've seen them hunting in packs, as in the Bridgeport case. I wouldn't have called it that then, but I certainly would now. So we're dealing with another form of life here that is a threat to us, if only to the peace and serenity of our families, perhaps even to our governments.
Can you describe to whatever physical vision you had of these things when they were sort of halfway there? What were you seeing?
Well, in the Bridgeport case, and in a number of cases since then, I've seen them in different ways. Now, I'm primarily a feeler of these things. In other words,
yes.
You know, I'm very good at telling where they are and sort of just by feeling the electrical energies and this sort of thing.
Right.
But at times I do see them. And in this Bridgeport case, they were rather gauzy. That's the best term I can use, sort of whitish, but not very clear. The clearest one I've ever seen was in 1998 in the case in New England here, where there was a woman who was, this is a classic parasite situation, a woman who was very vulnerable, a victim. And this thing was literally, trying to feed from her, and I followed it out into a yard, the backyard of the house. It was very dark, and the electrical energy that these things seemed to generate was very strong. I walked down toward the middle of it, because I'm not afraid of these things. They're more afraid of me than I am of them, I think. And I could see it. Arms, it looked like almost like a flash of lightning that kind of stayed there for a second. And it was almost like plasma. You know. And I believe these may be plasma-based life forms. On the other hand, I think the more they are in, if you want to say, our bubble world, the clearer they appear to be. I've run into parasites that were, particularly one in Canada in 1973, I believe, and it was a really, really clear man in a checkered shirt. I call it, you know, the ghost in a checkered shirt, 1975. And, you know, it was really very much in our world. Others that are not do not seem very clear. So I think this plasma-like look is not what they actually necessarily look like, but I think that what they appear to be, depending on how close they are.
Amazing stuff. Paul, hold on tight. We're at the top of the hour. Just absolutely incredible stuff. Paul Eno is my guest. I'm Art Bell.